Good evening. We are in term four. I think it's session three. Three or four, something like that. Term four, session four, term four, session three. And we're now holding in the sixth chapter at the second pasuk. That's the 6:6:2, essentially, in Megillas Esther. And in order to introduce tonight, I wanted to read you a Medrash Rabbah from Esther Rabbah, Parsha Tes, Ois Dalad. That's section 9.4. And it says as follows. After Haman made the gallows, he went to look for Mordechai. Remember last time we discussed, he went and made some gallows out of thorns. And where did he find him? He found him in the study hall with children sitting before him with sackcloth on their loins. They were dressed in sackcloth, which is very uncomfortable. And they were studying Torah. And they were all crying and all weeping. And Haman counted them and found that there were 22,000 children there. 22,000 children, all the Yiddish children of Shushan, were there learning and weeping with Mordechai. Why 22,000? So the Eitz Yosef on the Medrash says, these 22,000 counter the 22,000 angels that accompanied God when he went to offer the Torah to all the other nations of the earth. And even at Mount Sinai they accompanied him, although he brought more angels with him later. Those 22,000 are one myriad, which is 1,000 angels, for each of the 22 letters of the Aleph base. So there was a myriad of angels accompanying God for each letter of the Torah. And Mordechai gathered 22,000 children in order to be able to hearken back to the merit of Mount Sinai and the giving of the Torah, hoping God would forgive whatever sin has led to this particular position where they're now literally at death's door. So there were 22,000 children sitting with him and they were all crying. And he cast iron chains on them and appointed guards over them. And he said, tomorrow I will kill these children first. And afterwards, I'll hang Mordechai. That he already had said, if earlier we discussed quite a while ago, that when Mordechai found the children that told him the three psukim that we say after Aleinu, and he was overjoyed, he told Haman about that. And Haman already threatened to kill the children before he kills Mordechai anyway. So the mothers of the children brought them bread and water. And they said to them, at least eat and drink before you die tomorrow, because you might die of starvation. This is a 3-day fast. And if you're fasting from that long, it's better at least you die at execution of Haman than you die at the execution of being starved to death, which is a horrible way to go. So the kids put their hands on their svarim, and they swore, holding up their svarim, by the life of our teacher Mordechai, we will neither eat nor drink. Rather, we shall die while we're still fasting. So they said to their mothers. This is after Haman had put chains on them. And they all wailed and were screaming out. And their cries came up to Hashem. And they went up to Shemayim. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu heard the sound of their weeping during the second hour of the night. So God heard their prayers at that particular time because a 3-day fast is actually supposed to extend 2 hours into the fourth day. That's at that time that marked the conclusion of their fast. And it was then, only at the end of their fast, like at Ne'ilah of Yom Kippur, which is the climax of Yom Kippur, only then did HaKadosh Baruch Hu answer their tefillahs. He waited to give them the whole schus and saying, right, you're fasting to me. I'll answer you right at the very end of your fast. And it was at that moment, the second hour of that night, which was stretching from day three to day four, halakhically, that Hashem was aroused and stood up, as it were, from the throne of judgment, and he went, as it were, and sat on the throne of mercy. All this is figurative. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't have a body, and he can't get up from a seat and go to another seat, i.e. that means he was interfacing prior with the concept of the middah, the attribute of justice, and he moved from there to the attribute of mercy. And he said, what is this loud noise that I hear that sounds like the crying of kids and lambs? That's God saying that figuratively in Shemayim. And Moshe Rabbeinu, who we know has been waiting in the wings this whole time for davening, and indeed Mordechai and Esther were worried about that, because maybe they won't get a tikkun for Shevet Binyamin. He came before Kodesh Baruch Hu and said, now's the time for me to daven. Rabbeinu Shalom said Moshe Rabbeinu, there are neither kids nor lambs, but they are the members of your children, your nation, who have been immersed in Torah and fasting for 3 days and three nights. And tomorrow, Haman intends to slaughter them as if they were kids and lambs. At that very moment, HaKadosh Baruch Hu took the letters containing the decree against Klal Yisrael, which had been sealed in clay, as Moshe told Eliyahu to tell Mordechai, and he tore them all up. That was the moment in the sixth perek of Esther, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu has had enough of his children suffering, and he tore up the decree. What was the first thing he did? He cast restlessness upon Ahasuerus during that night. As it says, the king's sleep was disturbed. And that's what we did last week. The king's sleep was disturbed, so he commanded to bring the book of records, the book of chronicles, that they read before the king. Says the Medrash, the very heavens and the throne of Hashem was disturbed, for he saw Klal Yisrael, and the whole of Israel, in a state of deep distress. And he says, I and all of heaven am so distressed, and I'm going to let Ahasuerus sleep soundly? No. No. He's a king. I'm a king. And I'm going to make sure he can't sleep. There's going to be no sleeping before me when I am so distressed. So rather, what did he do? He made King Ahasuerus had a dream where he saw Haman seizing a sword with which to kill him. And he woke up and he thought this dream was a portent of reality. And he immediately told all of his secretaries to bring in the book of chronicles, the book of records, to see what had happened in the past. And they opened the books and they found the record relating that Mordechai had informed the king regarding the attempt on his life by Bigson and Seresh. Thus far the Medrash Rabbah. So that was 9:4 to 10:1 that I just went through with you. So we see that this is a denouement moment in the changeover between HaKadosh Baruch Hu being okay with the children of Israel going through all this terror, where he just says, enough, that's it, it's all over, now I'm going to turn the tables. And that's all happening at 6:1, 6:2. And this is exactly where we pick up our pasuk, right here in 6:2. That's the verse we're on. V'yimotzei kosev asher higid Mordechai al bigsono, with an aleph at the end. V'seresh. Bigsono is spelt wrong. His name wasn't Bigsono. His name was Bigson. Beis gimel sof nun. Not Beis Gimel Sof Nun Aleph. What's going wrong? Is there some misspelling here? And it was found. What do you mean, and it was found? What do you think it would be found? Of course it was there. It wasn't found. It was there. And they read. No, it was found. That Mordechai had told about Bigsono and Seresh, two royal chamberlains, from the gatekeepers who plotted to assassinate the king, Ahasuerus. This is an important pasuk. There is a lot going on here. So let's do it together. Now remember we said there was a book of Chronicles, which was a huge book, that was always by the king's side, and scribes were always jotting down in depth what's going on every day of the king's life. It's like a journal, a diary, to be pored over by historians in the future. But you can't go through all that stuff. So at the same time as writing the Book of Chronicles, they also had a small index book called the Book of Records, which basically had bullet points saying generally what was going on and where to look it up in the Book of Chronicles. So when he said, bring me the Book of Records, they needed the Book of Records because he was looking for something specific. He was saying, has there ever been a time where someone did me a favor and I didn't repay them? Why was he worried? Because if he didn't repay them, no one will come to him and tell them that actually Haman and probably Esther are plotting against you to kill you and steal the throne for themselves. Which is how he's woken up with this crazy conspiracy theory put in his head by God, by the Medrash Rabba, who decides that's it. Ahasuerus ain't sleeping. If my kids ain't sleeping and I'm not sleeping, as it were, I can't rest in tranquility, then you ain't going to sleep. But he really caused him tremendous consternation. So he's now consulting the index to rifle through the Book of Chronicles to find some kind of leverage or justification to fulfill his conspiracy theory. He's got a completely made up, untrue conspiracy theory that he now wants to find data to say, I knew it. I missed paying off this guy and now my life is in danger. So the record book didn't contain the full account. The only main point of the episode was that Mordechai had told about Bigsana on Seresh. That's all it said. It was found that Mordechai talked about Bigsana and Seresh. It did not include in-depth detail which led up to the event. Specifically, that Mordechai had told Esther and Esther in turn had told the king. That's all in the Book of Chronicles. You'll find that in the Book of Chronicles. That won't be in the Book of Records. Now, why? God wanted Ahasuerus to read in the Book of Records that Mordechai had saved the king from Bigsana Seresh. Doesn't mention Esther there, really. That's all in the in-depth discussion in the Book of Chronicles. Mordechai told Esther, Esther told the king, and then the king was saved. And then what happened? Actually, Haman was decorated because he felt as if Mordechai was nothing was going on there. And I've only got Esther as a queen because Haman put her there. So really, I owe Haman more because he saved my life because of Esther. If you remember, we discussed that. So he promoted Haman. What was the promotion, by the way? That everyone that sees him should get up and prostrate themselves before him. That was a royal decree that you had to do it. And that was specifically what Mordechai would not do. But that was in return to Haman for having promoted Esther and Esther having foiled the plot of Bigsana and Seresh. So he felt as if he owed Haman more than he owed Esther. Because if it wasn't for Haman, I would never have Esther to tell me that. Mordechai, though, is mentioned. He never had anything to do with Mordechai. Ooh, this fuels the flame of his conspiracy theory. Maybe Mordechai knows something about Haman and Esther. He ain't telling me because what's the point? I never paid him. Interesting. All right. So that's very clear, Hashkacha Protis. That's divine specific providence. That the way that it was written was only mentioning Mordechai. And we need that now because we want to bring Mordechai to the fore. Now, it's very clear from the records that Mordechai tried to save the king's life. It says Mordechai had told about Bigsana and Seresh. We're going to come to this Bigsana, not Bigsan business. And that made Ahasuerus ask, what honor and grandeur has been bestowed upon Mordechai, because he knew what he had done for Haman in that event. He remembered that, the whole bowing down to him business. But what have I done for Mordechai? Now, before we get onto the answer of that, we need to talk about Bigsana and Seresh. Now, if you have a look, it says, Al Bigsana v'Seresh. That's what it says in the Pasuk. So there's Beis Gimel Sof Nun Aleph, Vov Sof Reish Shin. Okay, let's have a look at this. Very, very important point that's brought in the Medrash Rabba. Very important point. The real names were Bigson and Teresh, not Bigsonah. But who were the scribes that used to write the record books? None other than Haman's sons. Haman's sons were the scribes. And they were in the room with the Achashverosh right now, along with the chamberlains, and they were reading out from the record book. Now, when they wrote down this matter about Bigson and Seresh, it would cast Mordechai in a very positive light. This is before anything had happened directly. Anti-Semites always underreport the good that Jews do, and they always overreport the bad that Jews do. This goes back to Solomon and the Queen of Sheba, who said, had I have only known half of what they told me about what's going on in Jerusalem, I would have come earlier. I didn't realize how great this place was. We learn from that that there is a policy amongst anti-Semites to bury any data which could leave Jews in a good light. This has gone back to the time of antiquity, and we surely see it today. But that was also part and parcel of the propaganda machine of Nazi Germany. You couldn't say Baruch Hashem for the Jews, who had built up Germany into be such a wonderful center of culture, science, medicine, art. It was amazing. A lot of those people were Jews. No, we had to rip that up and then misreport it and say, actually, they're terrible, they're vermin, they're parasites, which is really not true. Happening right here, right now. What did they do? When the scribes decided to write down the whole thing with Bigson and Seresh, they wanted to write it as Bigson, Oy Seresh. Look at this. Beis Gimel Sof Nun, that's Bigson, space, Aleph Vav, Oy, which is Hebrew for or, which is where the English word comes from, Oy, or, and then Sof Reish Shin. So it was Bigson, Oy Seresh. It was Bigson, or Seresh that was saved. What's something going on? What does that mean? The text became ambiguous and they didn't want the text to be read clearly. The idea was that when you read it years later, whoever's going to check it up, there'd be a question as to whether the person who informed on Bigson's plot was Mordechai or Seresh. We know Bigson wanted him dead, but who told Esther? Who told the king? It could have been Mordechai, or it could have been Seresh. Because you could have read the radical book, Mordechai had told about Bigson, or he had told about Bigson had told about Seresh or something like that. It was unclear. Seresh had told about Bigson. So what does that mean? It means that they actually wrote Oi as a separate word. Now, you could also say that their intention was to deceive the reader into thinking that Mordechai's favour to the king was very minimal. Because even though Bigson and Seresh both plotted against the king, Mordechai informed only on one of them. He might have informed about Bigson, or he might have informed about Seresh, but he didn't inform about both of them. And some unknown person who's not in the records told you about the other one. Either which way, it undermines Mordechai's being crucial and solely crucial to saving the king's life. So the text of the record book originally said that Mordechai had told about Bigson, or he told about Seresh, or someone else told about Bigson, maybe it was Seresh himself. So God did an ace. God got involved. What did he do? He took the word oi, aleph, vav, and he split up the letters and he pushed the letters to each side. So it read Bigsonot v'seresh, not Bigson oi seresh. God did that. He did that with the ink. So he moved the letters aside So that's why when they looked up in the record book, it said Bigson or Seresh. Now, even though we got the name Bigson wrong, at least we know Mordechai was definitely involved, and he was the one that grassed up both of them. And that's key, because without that, the king would have been dead. Indeed, who actually did Bigson and Seresh, as we learned, consider the best advisor as to how to go about killing the king? None other than Haman himself. Haman was the one that says poison is water. It was Haman's idea. They went to him. So what did his sons do? His sons didn't want to give any joy to Mordechai. There's Bigsono Seresh. And Hashem made it so it was Bigsono Seresh. And he split up that word. And that's why we read it Bigsono Seresh. So the oi has been deleted and been incorrectly misspelled onto the names. That's fine. You still get pshat, you still got the basic understanding, but you don't lose the gadlus, the greatness of Mordechai. Very, very important idea there. Now, what's this, and it was found? That's why it was found. Remember, who were the scribes? The scribes were Haman's sons. They knew what they wrote. Big son, i.e. Seresh. And yet, when they looked in the record book, what did they find? Big son of Seresh. It was literally found as a new thing. Even they were shocked. They were like, hold on, we didn't write this. We didn't write Big Son of Seresh. Why would we do that? We knew the guy's name was Big Son. It's like they found it brand new. That's why the Pasuk says, and it was found. That's something that you're definitely going to gloss over if you read this, you know, very fast. That's what it means, and it was found. It was found by the very people who had written it like that themselves, that their very plan to make Mordechai ambiguous had been carboshed in ways they couldn't understand. Could they have maybe written the Aleph too close to Bigson? It's interesting. The king usually didn't look at the text as it was being written. So he would sit in his bed and he'd have a guy with a book like reading him a story. And the storybook would be facing the scribe. But he didn't trust them. Why didn't he trust them? Because they're Haman's sons. And he's just had this dream that Haman's got a sword to kill him. So he told the scribe, turn around. Just turn your chair around and I'm going to read over your shoulder. Now, what would have happened when it was found, Big Son of Seresh? The scribes would have read it out either as Big Son of Seresh or deleted the whole thing and not read it Bichlal. They'd have just skipped over that line. But because they were now facing the king, like they've got their book here, and they're facing the king and they're reading it out like this, and the king's reading over their shoulder, they couldn't delete those words because the king was reading along with them. Because he was already suspect to these scribes because he's worried about their dad. That's what it means, it was found written. Because the scribes did their utmost to either delete or misread it. And Achashverosh reading, Mordechai talking about Bigson Seresh. Ooh! Which was not what they originally wrote to start with. So had Achashverosh looked at this a day earlier, he wouldn't have found that. This is a new thing. Verse 3. Vayoma HaMelech Manna Asah Yaka Gadoyle LeMordechai Alzeh. What honor and grandeur has been bestowed upon Mordechai for this? Alzeh. Why did he need to write that? Just say, what honor and grandeur has been bestowed upon Mordechai? We know. What is this for this? Alzeh. Do we need those words? Those are completely superfluous. Delete that. We wouldn't lose anything, right? There's something going on. Now, the king's servants, the Na'arei, the lads of the Melech, Meshurasov, who were attending to him, they were the ones, lo nase meodava, nothing's been done about it. Why didn't the scribes say it? They didn't say anything, because they're Haman's sons. They didn't want to say anything. They didn't want to say, actually, you've not paid this due. So the people that were around the scribes, the chamberlains, they said nothing had been done. They should have just said, lo na'asa, nothing had been done. Why imoy dava about him with this matter? We obviously know what's going on. What's all the words? What's being told to us in like this cryptic fashion, like a subtext here? What's this for this, Alzeh? What's been done for Mordechai for this, for saving my life? What's going on? If you remember, in 3:1 is the whole thing of Big Son and Seresh, and Mordechai overhearing the plot. It says, after these things, the king Ahasuerus promoted Haman. Why? Even though he was the one that actually was the one that told them how to poison the king's water so he could kill the king and take the throne himself. And then he'll do away with Big Son and Seresh afterwards. Amazing. He was so conniving. Big Son and Seresh went to Haman and said, what can we do? He goes, yeah, good point. Poison his water. What he was going to do is let them kill the king, have them killed because they killed the king, and then because he's number two, assume power in the throne. It made a lot of sense to him to tell them how to do it. Now, the king saw that it was Esther that was the one that told him about Big Son and Seresh's plan. And he felt, as we said earlier, that, you know what, I wouldn't have had this wonderful wife if it wasn't for Haman. So I'm going to promote him by making everybody bow down to him. That's going to be my special prize to Haman for saving my life. Because really, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have Esther. And then Big Son of Seresh might have killed me. So I'm going to make this big thing. Everyone's got to prostrate themselves down to Mordechai. So we know that there has been a promotion of honor on this very case to someone else. But what's been done for Mordechai in this particular case? I gave Haman grandeur, but I haven't given Mordechai anything. Can anyone tell me anything? And I said, no, you haven't given him a thing. But you gave Haman what? You had this whole bang down business. Remember, all this is happening in front of Haman's sons. Think how uncomfortable they were witnessing this whole thing happen in front of their very faces. That's what it means. Also, it means Mordechai told about a plot which was conspired against the king. So to knock on the head any idea that it was a very offhand manner, that he just happened to mention something about Big Son, Oi Seresh, to Esther. And then Esther heard that from someone else, that it was the other one as well, and then saved the king. No, Mordechai was specifically involved in this, and nothing had been done with him about this matter. This matter was that he was directly involved. So the king himself has seen the record in the record book, and they're looking it up in the Book of Chronicles, and Tucker points out, nothing's been done for Mordechai. This is all happening with Haman's sons turning the pages, I'd like to point out. Mamish, imagine the undoing of the Third Reich and getting the SS to be the ones that have to actually tick off the destruction of the Third Reich. It's like amazing. So the king's question really was, what honor and grandeur has been bestowed upon Mordechai? I need to give everything that I've given to Haman to Mordechai. Why? Because if he knows about the plot between Esther and Haman to kill me and steal my throne, he for sure won't say anything now because you realise that I never did anything for him in the past. So if I've given this to Haman, I've got to give at least the same kind of thing to Mordechai. Otherwise, I'm not paying fair's fair and people won't come and help me when I need it. So when he said what honour and grandeur has been done, he also meant for this particular act specifically. I know already Mordechai sits at the gate and that's a high honour. He's, you know, within the king's chambers, as it were, you know, in the courtyard. But what honour has been done for... No, he goes, oh, no, he was sitting in the gate ages ago, said the chamberlains. He's been in the gate. Hey. Yes, he's got honour. But the honour you gave him wasn't for this. Haman's sons must have been cringing. They'll be only too happy to. No. He got to sit in the gate because of this. It's all done. Leave him. Go, no. He was in the gate anyway. That's why it was the king's servants who were attending him and not the scribes that said this, because the scribes wanted to keep silent. It was very interesting. Very, very interesting. If you want to get really into it, it says, nothing had been done to him. That's really what they should have said. But what did they say? Nothing has been done with him. With him. What's been done with him rather than to him? If you remember, we learnt together in Ruth 2:19, it says, the name of the man with whom I worked today is Boaz. What do you mean, whom I worked today? You don't. In the name of the man whose field I worked today was Boaz, not the man in whom I worked today. Right? What did he mean? Why did she say she had worked with him? It should have said the name of the man who gave me. So what did we say? We brought Rus Rabba 5:9 that said, what does it mean? When someone does someone else tzedakah, both gain. The person who gets the money gains the money, but the person who gives the tzedakah becomes a bal tzedakah. So if you do yourself a favor, when you give someone else a favor, Achashverosh was saying, it isn't that I really want to decorate this Jew, stum because I love decorating Jews. I'm only going to bestow honor because I'm doing myself a favor, that by doing him this tremendous favor of grandeur, I'll get people to protect me when I need it. That's why it says in Pirkei Avos, be very, very careful about politicians and ministers of the government. They may act friendly to you, it's only because they need something from you. You're only going to be called into the palace because they want something from you. They need you more than you need them. When Achashverosh was doing with him some kind of favor, whatever it's going to be, we know it's going to be dressing him up and putting him on a horse. He wasn't doing that because he wanted to give Mordechai anything. He was doing that because he wanted to give himself something. The insurance that people will come and tell him about conspiracy plots. That's what he's doing for himself. Doesn't mean what's done with him. Just like Boaz did good with Rus, not knowing that Rus and Boaz are actually going to become a married pair. He was doing himself a favor by helping her. And of course, by doing tzedakah, he was doing himself a favor in merit. That's what was going on Rus 2:9 that we learned, 2:19 that we learned together. Interesting idea. Okay. Now, one of the things that was making Achashverosh quite uncomfortable was that he was fully aware that he had sold the Jews to their death with Haman. And he's got a Jew here who he's going to need to give honor and grandeur to. And it makes him uncomfortable to feel as if, you know, it's all a bit weird that I'm going to be, you know, upgrading you. But at the end of the day, I don't know how much you're really going to get out of this because you're going to be dead, in a few months. So it actually made him feel uncomfortable that he hadn't done anything for Mordechai. And he's repaid him evil for good. Mordechai saved his life and he's just signed a decree to kill his. So he really felt particularly guilty. And now he's sure that Mordechai won't help him, because if Mordechai gets whiff, which he probably has from the internal memo that we talked about the destruction of the Jews, there's no way he's going to save Achashverosh, which means Achashverosh knows he's on the back foot here with trying to get Mordechai some honor. Just at that moment, when all of this is peaking in the middle of the night, think about this, try to put yourself in the room. There's Achashverosh and he's really feeling, think about how he's feeling. He's going through this whole conspiracy theory. He believes Haman's out to get him, and yet he's sold the Jews to Haman to do what he wants with them. And now he owes a Jew his life, and Haman's children in the room, and it's all really, really uncomfortable. And he's asking, well, who was in charge? Who's in charge of the scribes? Who would have not told me about who was the head scribe at that time was Haman. Now, of all people to be walking into the king's office in the middle of the night, in came Haman. And what was he doing there? We discussed last week that his wife told him, you've got to go get him hanged because the Jews don't get saved when they're hanged. So what did he do? He wanted to summon all the forces of the Sotan, who's his guardian angel, the guardian angel of Amalek. And the Sotan has most power in the middle of the night. He says, you know what? Instead of waiting until tomorrow morning, I'll go when my angel is at the strongest, and I'll go in the middle of the night and I'll go ask Achashverosh to kill Haman. So let's just get the scene. Haman's sons are in the room. The chamberlain's in the room. He's there perplexed about this whole thing. And as soon as he's at the denouement of that, the crux of that, Haman walks in asking the king to slaughter Mordechai. At that very moment, what are the chances? He was there to say, listen, I've got a personal favour. I need you to hang Mordechai on the gallows. He was on his way in. Verse 4. Vayomer HaMelech, mi b'chotzo. And the king said, who's in the courtyard? Now, what does that mean? We need to decide. Why would he ask who's in the courtyard? He's asking who's in charge? Where are the ministers in charge of the scribes? We'll get to that. Now, Haman had come to the outer courtyard of the palace to tell the king that he should hang Mordechai on the gallows, which he prepared for him out of a thorn bush. That's what he was doing there. What are the chances of these things coalescing at that moment? Verse 5. So the king's servant said to him, almost in shock, you know what? The very man is it. Funny you should ask at this moment. Haman is actually standing in the courtyard. Let him come in. That's verse 5. Very good. Let him come in. In fact, good that he's here. I've got to have a word with him. Why did he say Mibachotzer? Who's in the courtyard? The king was asking, what powerful minister in my court did not fulfill his duty to grant reward to someone who's worthy of it in order to perpetuate my life? And if I'm unaware that this reward is due, then the minister responsible should have brought it to my attention. And it was Haman. It happened to be, it was Haman. And then they said, actually, well, Haman's the chief scribe. But where's Haman? Ah, Haman's just there. He's just there, actually. He's just there. Bring him in. Bring him in. I'm going to give him a ribbing. Now, Haman, of course, has a completely different reason as to why he's there. Amazing. Now, we did say that Haman wanted to utilize this power in the middle of the night. And in fact, just as he was trying to trick the king into hanging Mordechai, he himself was tricked into aggrandizing Mordechai. The complete opposite of what he wanted to do. And exactly what Zeresh, his wife, had told him, Mordechai's going to be high in your house. You're going to be involved in his grandeur. And there he goes, early, like Bilam saddled his donkey early, with Zerizus, with zealousness, to go and get Mordechai killed. And he can go now and get Mordechai aggrandized. Verse 6. So Haman came. They call for Haman. And then he comes. You know, all happy and cheery. You know, he doesn't know what's going on. His son's in the meantime. Could you imagine his son? They'd want to tell him, Dad, keep quiet. They know what's going on. Their dad walks in. They can't say a thing. They're watching this whole thing crumble in front of their eyes. So the king said to him, out of the blue, by the way. Now notice, we're going to discuss this. Wouldn't the right thing for King Ahasuerush to have said to Haman, his first thing is, what are you doing here in the middle of the night? What you wanted to speak to me and wake me up at midnight? It happens to be I'm up tonight, but what brings you here, Haman? You should have just started to let the ball roll. Well, actually, I wanted to ask the king a favor. What favor's that? Now imagine had that had played out. That would have been horrendous. We'll discuss that in a second. So Haman walks in, all aghast. We'll discuss why Ahasuerush didn't say anything. And Ahasuerush always got a bee in his bonnet. And he goes, what should be done to the man who the king desires to honour? Now remember, at this stage, Ahasuerush doesn't like Haman. He'd just woken up with a dream of the man that he's talking to trying to kill him. And he, like Pharaoh and like Nebuchadnezzar, who had dreams of bad portent, is sure this guy wants to kill him, which isn't true, by the way, at this particular point in time. But he's sure of it now. So he's very clear to say to Haman something which is ambiguous because he thinks Haman will want it for himself. He's now trying to trick Haman himself. Everyone in the room knows what's going on, the scribes, the chamberlains. The only person who doesn't know what's plotting is Haman. So he just says, what should be done to the man whom the king desires to honour? He's leading Haman on. Now, Haman thought to himself, says the Pasuk, whom would the king desire to honour or give greater honour than to me? I'm number 2 in the entire realm. That is absolutely amazing. So why didn't he say, what are you doing here? We're going to discuss that. That's a very important point, why he didn't say that. Now, it's like this. He wanted to call for the record book to look for an episode which related a man who had secretly informed the king of something, but whom he neglected to reward. And he believed that if anyone knew the conspiracy between Haman and Esther, he would have no incentive to report it anymore. That's why the king wished to honour the man now for his previous service. But Ahasuerush thought to himself as follows. If I let him know that actually I want to give all this to Mordechai rather than to him, I won't get anything. Why did he think that? Because granting honour alone is not going to motivate a person who knows about the conspiracy to come forward. such a man is still going to withhold the information, thinking that the king's, you know, I'll inform someone else, maybe the king's chamberlains. But who's specifically going to reveal such a high level, high treason to the king himself? Haman and Esther, who are now plotting together to kill the king in his mind, would definitely forestall that. The king thought of Haman as a potential usurper. And so he didn't state who the honour was for to keep Haman on the back foot, because he wants Haman to be involved in the aggrandisement. Why? So the person thinks like this, whoever it is that this person is that needs to get honoured, they're going to think like this. If Haman has to honour me, I'm safe to approach the king directly and let him know that Haman and Esther want to kill him. Now, I'd be scared to tell the king that normally, because they'll probably kill me. I mean, Haman and Esther will probably kill me first. But if I've got Haman at my feet, as it were, I'm safe to personally go to the king and tell him of this conspiracy and save his life. That's what the king needed to big up. He needed to big this guy up so big that he'd be able to approach the king and say, look, I've got to tell the king really important news, which is what he needed. So that's why he kept Haman shtum and said, what would you do to someone you want to honour? I.e., you think it's you, but actually I'm going to involve you in this because you're my prime target. I need people to tell me you want to kill me. This is all in his head. All in his head because HaKadosh Baruch Hu put that dream in his head. Because of the children that were sitting, crying, fasting. At the end of 3 days fast. The koyach of Klal Yisrael's tefillahs came out in what seems like a mad conspiracy theory in the mind of a crazed king. That was God's reward. How unusual. It's interesting, in the beginning, he only spoke of honour, not grandeur. Because otherwise, Haman might have chapped, he'd have picked up, that maybe he himself would not be the focus of this gift. Because the king has already bestowed upon Haman the greatest grandeur that anyone could receive by placing him above all the other ministers in a separate throne. He had a seat that was higher and separate to everyone else. And he had this thing that everyone's got to bow down and prostrate themselves to him. So there's no more grandeur he could bestow. So if he says what could be done to honour the person, why didn't he say and bestow grandeur? If he says bestow grandeur, there's no more grandeur to be bestowed upon me. Who could he have in mind? And that would have changed that. So the king carefully kept the dialogue very, very terse. And said, I want to honour someone. So he thought, look, honour you could always have more of. Grandeur, there's only so far you can go. So if I can have more honour, it must be me he's talking about. So you know what? I'm going to give up my, you know, my daisy dream, you know, my daydream as to whatever it is I would like. And he's going to rattle off whatever it was he wants. Now, it's very, very important at this point to keep Esther out the loop. Let's talk about plan B. Can we talk about what would have gone wrong had the king have said, what are you doing here? Now, it turns out that the Alshe HaKadosh says that God actually inspired Ahasuerus not to ask the question and to get straight on with brass tacks and say, what's going on to a man that the king wants to honour? Why didn't he say, it's good you're here, Haman, sit down, have a cup of tea. Very strange to see you here at midnight. What brings you here? Before he lays upon him this whole thing. Haman would have said, actually, in front of everyone who would be cringing, I'm actually here to ask the king a personal favour. What's the personal favour you would like, Haman? He goes, actually, I wouldn't mind if you'd allow me to hang Mordechai, who is a magistrate, a judge in the kingdom. I think he's a bit of a dodgy one, and it would be good if we could kill him. Now, remember, had he said that to him, that would have absolutely fueled the fires of his conspiracy, because he thinks Mordechai is the only one that could actually tell him about Haman and Esther. And in comes Haman asking to hang him. That would proof of the pudding that Haman and Esther are up to something. Now, what's the problem with that? It implicates Esther. That's a problem. Killing Haman wouldn't be so bad at this particular point in time. Having Esther demoted or killed herself would be horrendous. We need Esther to hatch the plan that we started off in Parakim Daled and Hay, in chapters 4 and 5, to say, if it pleases the king, I've got to tell you, there's someone that sold me your... We need that to happen, and we need him to annul the decree against the killing of the Jews. That's only going to happen if Esther has her special day at the party. If Haman comes in and says, I want you to kill Mordechai, he'll for sure think Esther and Haman are up to something and possibly kill them both now. And if that happens, the decree which he's already signed for 11 months is very much alive. We got a problem. So what's going on? God wanted him to get straight to the business of what he could do to honor Mordechai, rather than ask Haman what's going on to find out that Haman wants to kill Mordechai. Because had that happened, the cards would have fallen very differently and it would have been bad for Klal Yisrael. So God kept Ahasuerus very wound up and on edge, so that he couldn't so much think straight. He had to get on with what he wants to do and aggrandize Mordechai to give incentive to spill the beans on a plot, rather than find out in a more political, diplomatic, calm, cool, calculated way, why would Haman be here so in the middle of the night? We can't stop the music playing here. Otherwise, this would be horrendous. Horrendous. So, there's a Gemara in Megillah. Tes Zayin Omad Aleph. At 16a. And it says that when the king ordered Haman to do to Mordechai everything he had suggested, Haman actually objected. And he said, surely a lesser honor would suit Mordechai, who had no such concept of such greatness as me. So the king said, if you look at verse 10, if you just jump ahead to verse 10, when he's actually telling him to go and do it, he says, and the king said to Haman, quickly take the garment and the horses you've spoken, and do so to Mordechai the Jew. Why did he say the Jew? That's an interesting question. Who sits at the king's gate. And look at this. Don't miss a single thing from everything you've suggested. Don't miss a beat. I don't want you to miss a single thing. I know you don't want this to happen, but I want you to do every single thing of every word you've just said to me now about how you're going to aggrandize the king, which we're going to read. I don't want you to give it to Mordechai. Because he said, no, I give him something, make him ride on a horse, but that's it. He goes, no, and the garments and the crown, the whole lot. And you walk in front of him, say, gosh, this so such a person. I want you to do the whole thing. Because he didn't want to do the whole thing. Now, because Haman didn't know it was Mordechai that was going to get all this, he dreamed up the most extravagant honor that only someone like him could dream up at his particular stage of life. By the way, him dreaming up all this honor about himself, and the king knows he thinks it's about himself because he set him up for it, confirms to him that Haman has ideas of grandeur for himself, which again is fueling the king's conspiracy theory. Verse 7, Pasuk Zayin. Vayomer Haman el Hamelech. Now this is a very interesting verse. This has got to be the oddest verse probably in the whole Megillah. It doesn't need to be there, and it's all weird, this verse. Haman said, the man whom the king desires to honor. End verse. And then in verse 8, they should bring a royal garment, which is the king's worn. What do we need verse 7 for? It seems all wrong. Now, it's interesting. Above the word ish, there's a cantillation sign, a trop sign, which has two vertical dots and one vertical bar. And that cantillation sign is called a zakef godel. A zakef godel. And that means you should sing it a bit like a fanfare. Da, 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 like a fanfare in front of the king. I.e. the man that you want to honor should be like a trumpet kind of thing. It's interesting that the word zakef godel literally means great stature. The actual name for the cantillation musical note is great stature. So the word ish, a man of great stature, that's how you read it. You hear that with a sound. Ish is sung with the sound of great stature. So that's the cantillation over the word ish. And the zakef godel above the word ish indicates that word is marked to be accompanied by a high fanfare as the person who's laying the Megillah Sinzikt, and as Haman is hoping he will be accompanied on this horse. Now, it's interesting that when it says the word ish, it's Anywhere you see ish in scripture, it always denotes a person of high rank or high importance. So the king wanted Haman to think that he was referring about Haman. That's what the king wanted him to think. A man of high status. And indeed, that he bit the bait immediately. You know, he forgot the whole thing about Mordechai and hanging Mordechai. Oh, now we're onto some real interesting stuff here. Yeah, the king wants to give me tremendous honor. Maybe I'll ask him about the hanging Mordechai later. Let's cash in now the king's in such a benevolent mood. So Haman ensured that Ahasuerus was referring to a man of exceedingly high status. Ish, the special Zakef Godel ish. So now he's got that. He can think up what he wants for himself. Look at verse 8. I tell you what they should do, O king. Here's what you should do for a man of exceedingly high stature, i.e. me. Bring a royal garment, which the king himself has worn, and a horse on which the king himself has ridden. Now, it's interesting. Look at this carefully. And that which is placed upon his head. Specifically, a royal crown. Now, that's very strange, Loshen. Just say, and a crown. And that which is placed upon his head. Come on, I mean, what are you talking about? Do you mean the crown? Amazing. Now, I think anybody with any shred of normalcy would be quite aghast at the brazen arrogance of Haman asking essentially to go in the royal car, right? In the royal, could you imagine some minister puts on the red ermine with that kind of like white and black dotty fur trim of ermines with little black tails of the stoats sewn onto it, and the crown on his head, and in the royal chariot, you know, waving at people as he goes by. That's what he'd like. That's what he'd want. That's a bit intense, don't you think? No one can do that. It's weird, right? Very interesting. Now, what's going on? This is a beautiful twist. Mordechai never prostrated himself in front of Haman, firstly for religious reasons, because he had an idol around his neck, and then secondly because he just hated him. He just forgot about him. He was just a totally irrelevant person. And that really drew Haman's anger. And that led to him essentially organizing a decree to kill all the Jews. Midah keneged midah, measure for measure, God set in the king's heart a desire that Haman gives honor to Mordechai in the very way he himself wants it. So there's a beautiful list that's brought by the Al Shech HaKadosh of six separate things that Haman did to Mordechai and that Mordechai got back at this very turnabout. Now there's one missing. There's one missing which we've got to discuss at great length. Number one, Haman wished to nullify, degrade, make Mordechai a nobody. In return, Haman was cast down like a slave before Mordechai. Two, Mordechai did not bow down to Haman. So what happened? When Mordechai went to get on the horse, Haman had to bend over and turn himself into a step, like a footstool, for Mordechai to climb up onto the horse. So he ended up bowing down to Mordechai. Mordechai never bowed down to Haman. Haman bowed down to Mordechai. Number three, Mordechai, as we just learned from the Medrash at the beginning of tonight's shiur, he wore sackcloth to try to push the Jews to repent, and the Jews put on sackcloth. Midah keneged midah, he wore sackcloth, extremely uncomfortable, lowly slave kind of wear. He's now wearing the garment of the king himself. Number four, Mordechai was going around the streets crying out to ask everyone, A, not to go to the party, and B, to do tshuva. And in those very same streets that he was running around begging the Jews not to go to the party and telling them to do tshuva, he himself is now walking, driving around on the king's horse, being promulgated and being honoured in those very same streets. Number five, Mordechai placed ashes on his forehead in mourning, which is why it says in 4:1, so he put ashes on his head. Measure for measure, God says, you're going to put ashes on your head for me to get the kids to do tshuva? I'm telling you, you're going to wear a crown. Kodesh Baruch Hu says that head is fitting to wear the royal crown. And lastly, Mordechai called out with a great and bitter cry in those streets saying, don't go to the party. Do tshuva, do tshuva. And now he's got his arch enemy, Haman, walking out, screaming ahead of him. This is what's going to be done to the man who the king deserves to honor. Measure for measure, six things. But one thing isn't paid off. We learn out in 4:1 that not only did he don sackcloth, but he rent his garments. He tore his garments. Now, Rabbi Sai, it was worth coming tonight for this moment. It's a worth coming moment. If you were thinking, should I come, shouldn't I come? Here's where it gets to the worth coming moment. When he tore his garments, God didn't pay him back for that. For all the other six things we've mentioned, God was very careful to pay him back in spades. You did this for me, I'll do that for you. You did that for me, I'll do this for you. God's extremely careful to pay his debts. Mordechai tore his garments in 4:1. That you can keep. I'm not paying you back on that one. Why not? Why not? Cast your minds back to Bereishis, Genesis 44, 12 and 13. All the brothers come to Yosef, and Yosef pretends to be a cruel, harsh viceroy, suspecting these Jews of being spies, spying out Egypt. They're like, no, we aren't. We aren't doing it. And he returned their money in their sacks, and they went back to their father. They were very upset. They came back. They brought double the money. And what did he do? When they brought Binyamin at his request, and then he sent them all away, he got his special silver goblet, the one he made a big issue about utilizing for divination, and he had it hid in Binyamin's sack. He had it hid in Binyamin's sack. Then he sent them out of the country. Then he told his son, who's Menashe actually, goes, go after them and say, is this how you repay good with evil? My master looked after you and he gave you a meal and he was so nice to you and he let you go home and you steal his special silver cup? That's how you... And they go, oh, chas v'chalil. Chalil v'chas, we'd never do such a thing. Why would we do such a thing? They go, one of you's taken it. So they all got off their donkeys and they were quick to open their bags to show their innocence. And in whose rucksack did they find that goblet? Binyamin, who, by the way, was completely guiltless. He knew Yosef was Tavas Penechus and Aspenechus was Yosef. He knew that. Didn't say a word. He was doing great. He was a good boy. But they decided to hide it in his bag. So when they opened his bag, they found it. And they go, ha, you thieves. What did the other brothers do? All the other 10 brothers ripped their garments in grief on what they thought was Benjamin's account, even though he was guiltless. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is incredibly careful with what happens to his tzaddikim. He's very careful with the righteous. Even though Binyamin was guiltless, which he was, it was Yosef that framed Binyamin. True. The point is that at that moment, all the other brothers harbored deep resentment against Binyamin, saying, you did that. We brought you all the way here. And remember, Dad didn't even want you to come here. Dad was scared you'd come and you'd get killed or something like that. He'd lose all the children of Rachel. And then there was a whole thing with Reuven and Yehuda, who's going to make a pledge to look after you. This is what you do. And of course, he couldn't say because he knew. He was like, yeah, actually, I know. It's Yosef. So he's just silent, which looked very much like shtika ishador. Silence is a confession. And yeah, what can I do? You know, I pinched it. I really like it. Now, he wasn't like that. That's what they thought. So when they were going back to Egypt, imagine how everyone treated Binyamin. Oh, Binyamin's in trouble. With his own brethren. That's not his fault. God remembered that Binyamin, even though it wasn't his fault, caused his brothers deep anguish when Mordechai the Benjaminite tore his clothing in 4:1. God said, for everything else I'll pay him back, but for that, that can go back and atone for all the other brothers tearing their clothing when they heard about Binyamin. It doesn't seem to make sense. It wasn't Binyamin's fault. Yeah, but they thought it was. And it was on his account. And that's been a stain on Binyamin's heritage as far as God's concerned in heaven. Now that Mordechai's torn his clothing in distress because of his brothers, Measure for measure, he's tearing his dress because of his brother's behavior. And they tore their garments because of Binyamin's behavior. Now we can clear that one up and put that one to bed. So I'm not going to pay you back for that, because that's actually already paying off someone else's problem. That's paying off Binyamin's problem. Now remember, you and Esther are jumping really quickly here to go in before 30 days because you want to be Matak and Shavat Binyamin, and Moshe Rabbeinu isn't going to get all the glory for saving Klal Yisrael again. So if you really want to fix up Binyamin, you'll be happy that I don't pay you back for that one. That one can go back to the account of Benjamin himself, and you can clear that off for him. And that's why, of all things that God paid Mordechai back, he didn't pay him back the tearing of his garments. That is astonishing. Please God, next time, we'll learn rules about how Kodesh Baruch Hu deals with Tzaddikim in these cases. And then go on to the actual garments that were brought, and Haman himself leading Mordechai through the streets and begrudgingly admitting that he came in only to try to kill Mordechai. And look how it's all panned out. It must be the hand of God. Even he admits it. Like Pharaoh at the third plague, that is told by his wizards, it's got to be the finger of God here. There's no other way to explain these events. He himself says, yeah. You know, that very night I was coming to kill you, and I had no idea I'd be walking you through the streets of Shushan proclaiming your greatness. It can't be. Now remember, this is all happening in between the two parties. This is all happening in between the two parties. It's all in a 72-hour period. All these chapters now. It's all happening in 72 hours. Please God, we'll continue next week. And I look forward to finishing off as much of the sixth perek as I can with you. If hopefully I've got eyes on actually finishing it all the way through to Pasuk Yud Dalet. It's certainly within reach now. And then we can also see what became of Zeresh's ploy to have Haman hanged. Really backfired. And then, of course, the most important, what we're all working towards, is the seventh chapter. That's where Esther actually says to the king, my and my people have been killed. That's a plan that's been cooking all the way through since the fourth chapter. Getting there, that very pasuk is in the seventh perek. So now we're going to see a very big turnabout happening in the sixth perek, which completely leaves Haman on the back foot with Esther for getting to the party the next day for the second party, where Esther's going to actually drop him in the drink. So this is all leading up very beautifully. And remember, Haman now has got a bad picture in Ahasuerus's mind about him, because Ahasuerus had this weird dream that Haman wants to kill him, and maybe Esther's involved. So we've got to be very careful to keep Esther on the sideline, which is why Esther has to be very careful what she's doing as well, as we'll learn. And we have to keep Mordechai in good position for the last chapters, where we've got to be able to undo the decree that was set. Nonetheless, Haman is killed. The decree's already active. And if Mordechai wasn't in good position with the king, he wouldn't be able to assist the king in undoing the decree that had been set. So everything that's happening now is key for stages later. I look forward to doing that with you. Any questions? Now's the time. And I wish you a wonderful week and